The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great to be here, and we appreciate your being on board. We have a great program tonight, and let me run through the announcements so we can get right on with our guest, Dr. Bushnell. You can call us and talk with our guest. Our toll-free number, please write it down, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we're not using call screeners, so be patient. We'll answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And we do hold you over the break if that's applicable, and I do answer the phone over the break as well. Those of you who would prefer to use email for whatever reason, that address for tonight is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Do remember that The Space Show is trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download our programs and to share them with people you think may be interested in them. A 90-minute show is 40 megabytes or so, so if you need to know how to send that around on the Internet, please let me know, and I'll be glad to tell you how I do it. And also, nothing commercial with the programs, no edits or cuts for private YouTube channels or even your own website. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we thank you for honoring those very few requests. The Space Show is podcasting through gigadial.net. Andrew does that for us. You will find our RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters, and our podcasts are available in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, and a host of other places as well. And our website, thespaceshow.com, has a detailed, comprehensive newsletter that gets uploaded Sunday evening. And there you'll find all the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it's the only place we have a future events section for what's coming up on future Space Show programs. If we modify any of our programs during the week, you find those changes first on the website newsletter, so I urge you to stay current and check it from time to time. You can't miss it. It's in the middle of our homepage. And then if you would like to get by email early Monday morning the very short electronic version of our newsletter, just one or two lines about the week's programming, please send your email address to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived and available on our program going back all the way to 2001 when we started, and I think we're at show number 2055 or 2056, but they're all available on our website for you to download or listen. There's a store on our website, you'll see it up near the top, called Space Show Gear. But above all, you'll see the important Space Show support button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org. We're able to bring you all of these programs free of charge because of your support, and we thank those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us in the future. Remember, as a 501c3 nonprofit, you do get a federal tax deduction for your gifts, and the same for those of you that are in California, as we're a California public benefit corporation. Finally, remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative security solutions for space security. And for more information, you can check out their website, www.swfound.org. They are also the sponsors of our webinar series, and our next webinar is Sunday, August 18th, and Secure World is running that webinar, and it is about the topic of NEOs, and how best to deal with them here on Earth. So again, you'll hear more about that webinar as we move forward. I'm very happy to bring back to the Space Show Dr. Dennis Bushnell. Dr. Bushnell is the chief scientist at NASA Langley Research Center, and that's in Hampton, Virginia. He is responsible for technical oversight and advanced program formulation for a major NASA research center with technical emphasis in the areas of atmospheric sciences and structures, materials, acoustics, flight, electronics, control software, instruments, aerodynamics, aerothermodynamics, hypersonic air breathing propulsion, and the list goes on and on and on. He has over 252 publications and major presentations and 350 invited lectures and seminars. His full bio is on our website and our newsletter already. I urge you to check it out, but I would rather talk with our guest rather than read about him. He has written a paper which came to my attention, and the title of this paper is Advanced to Revolutionary Space Technology Options, the Responsibly Imaginable. And I put the URLs for this paper both in the email newsletter and the website newsletter so that you could easily go to the paper and download and print it out and hopefully read it before our program tonight. The URL is actually a little bit long to read on air, but again, if you go to the website newsletter or the email newsletter, you will see it there. A word of caution, there's something wrong with the Dreamweaver program that printed this week's website newsletter, so I think you'll have to copy the URL and then paste it into your browser rather than clicking on it. It takes you to an old link, and we can't get it out of Dreamweaver, so we're probably going to have to rebuild that template. But anyway, it's there. And this paper looks at a lot of the space capabilities and technology readiness levels, and it's a no-nonsense approach to our capabilities, what we need, what we have across all different space sectors. Dr. Bushnell, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you, sir?
Excellent. An honor and a privilege to be back.
And it's great to be talking to you again. And I want to start near the end of your paper because you, I think we can move forward into more detail. But among some of the things that you talk about in your conclusion, there's a cultural battle between glorifying the past or marching forward to the future, between protecting success or cannibalizing them, between averting risk or embracing it. The battle is on for the soul of the industry and the future of humankind in space. And you also talk about that the space community has been unwilling to make the right kind of investment in time and treasure to come up with the revolutionary technologies needed to really move forward and to work out with a high capital investment and lower the price and basically develop our space industry. And for whatever series of reasons, we haven't been doing that. Is that a fair assessment of how you summarize the overall space industry today?
The problem is the current space industry is based largely upon technologies developed in the 50s through the 70s. The space access and cost of space access is one of the major issues for doing much of anything in space. And the ways that we currently access space is based upon ICBMs designed in the 50s and even earlier German machines. We are still doing it with chemistry. We have not invested sufficiently in alternatives to chemistry, which I lay out in this paper, which no promises, but we will never know if they're better unless we look at them.
So if you look at the new propulsion systems that are coming online or being built, and you look at like SLS, and also if we go into the commercial sector and we look at SpaceX and the Falcon 9 rockets and eventually the Falcon Heavy, everything is still kind of what you said based on the old chemical propulsion and all of that. I mean, you know, where, why are we not moving forward with nuclear, for example? And I mean, I've done lots of shows on it. People support it. We'd like to see it happen, and yet it's not there.
When you say nuclear, you're presumably talking about nuclear fission.
Right, nuclear thermoelectric.
And, that has problems. It has political problems. It has potential problems, explosions during launch and so forth, which would make people very unhappy and possibly very sick. So, you know, we looked at that briefly with the Timberwind project, and we keep looking at it, and we keep saying, yeah, maybe for in space, but not for space launch. And those machines would give an ISP of about twice conventional chemistry. I mean, the hydrogen oxygen rockets are about 453.35 seconds all up, everybody happy and healthy. And the nuke thermal rockets are about twice that. And then the electric ones are even more than that. So, you know, that would be good for in space. And if we seriously want to do Mars fast transit, then that's probably what we'd have to go to in the nearer term. There are many other options in the farther term, which have very low TRL, but which somebody should look at to sort out, you know, where we are and what the possibilities are.
Where are the bottlenecks in moving forward with the kind of technologies and the kind of development program that you talk about in your paper?
The major bottleneck appears to me to be cultural. The people in this business want success. They want to pick winners up front. And in the kind of technologies I talk about, you can't do that. They seem to not realize or need a reminder that the way you go after really serious improvements are to try 10, 20, 30, or 100 of them and triage. In other words, spend a little bit of money on a lot of things, and then as you learn more, but triage and down select until you find two or three or one that will actually pan out. This is the way to work the risk that's associated with very low TRL, you know, farther term technologies. But there are many of these which have massive potential benefits and that get us around this business of space just being too expensive.
Aren't they trying to do that a little bit in the commercial crew program, where they ultimately they'll down select from the companies getting some funding from the government? On their commercial crew program?
The commercial crew program is still better living through chemistry. The commercial crew program is being successful, will be successful in getting out some of the costs of the marching armies that were in the NASA systems for many reasons. And, you know, SpaceX has been, you know, has leaned down their ground operations, and they have become lean manufacturing types, and overall, you know, they've been quite successful. It looks like they can cut the cost of access to space by a factor of two or possibly more. But that's not the factor of 10 that you need to seriously do space.
Over what time would it take to actually achieve a reduction by a factor of 10 if we were actually engaged in such a program today?
No guarantees, but the technologies in general would take 10 to 15 years to sort through, triage, and do the research, and then another 10 to 15 years to do the development. So you're talking about 25 to 30 years.
So that seems like a long time to a lot of us.
Well, of course it does. And, you know, that's the time it would take to look at very low TRL things and see which ones are right and to garner revolution. And you're exactly right. People want instant gratification or better. And they, you know, it's a strange. The Chinese purportedly have a 1,000-year planning cycle, the Japanese 140 years, and the U.S. has anywhere from the quarter on Wall Street to the 4-year presidential cycle. We do not generally exhibit the foresight that other people seem to do.
So we fund for 1 year, and we talk about a 5-year program usually, which doesn't really mean anything. Because it always changes year to year. So if we are going to engage, it would seem to me, in the kind of planning and development and incremental and R&D program that you're talking about, we would need to make some kind of change in how we fund projects, because a one-year funding program would not cut it the way we're doing things today.
One-year funding is the way Congress appropriates funds, and that's probably not going to change. You can do one-year funding. You can do incremental looks at things. But the overall planning has to include looks at very revolutionary, very iffy things. And the way you get around, as I said, the problem of risk, is to look at a very many of them and then triage. This is the way, the almost universal experience in commercial companies, as I've read it on new products, is 3,600 ideas for one viable new product after 8 to 10 years of development. So you need a great many new ideas initially, and then a triage and work on a smaller number as you learn more. But if you don't do that kind of homework up front, then the more revolutionary capability technologies will forever remain out of sight, not proven, and will remain where we are, which is that largely space, particularly humans, to places like Mars, the budgets are just not there to do it with existing technology. We're going to have to improve that technology and much more than an incremental one.
You have an email question from a spatial listener, Todd, in San Diego, California. And Todd says, it seems to me that in a roundabout way, you're advocating what a lot of us talk about, and that is that NASA should somehow change its focus to research and development and planning along the lines of what you're talking about, and let the commercial sector take over the Earth to low Earth orbit responsibilities, including the space station. Do you agree with that, or am I misinterpreting you?
My understanding, which is probably incomplete, of NASA's stance on that, it is, very similar to that. That is that the commercial crew effort is to do the, low Earth orbit with the commercial, because after all these years, we've been doing this since the 50s now. That is a commercial level thing. And then the beyond low Earth orbit is where you need the research, and that's where NASA is concentrated. Now, my personal view is that we also need research on low Earth orbit, that the current Better Living Through Chemistry that the commercial people are looking at, it is far from what we could do if we took the gloves off and did some low TRL research and sort of.
Okay, so and the commercials by definition are really not situated to do that type of research.
That's exactly right.
But NASA certainly is capable of doing that kind of research. Do you think that? Well, here, let me give you another question that just came in by email, and this is from Jay in Dallas, Texas. And he said, I did download and read your paper. Thank you, David, for giving that to us. I noticed that on one of the pages you talked about major reason for doing things in space is to explore space and to determine what is actually happening in physics. Many of us believe that the major reason for human spaceflight is space settlement. What do you think about that as a major driver for human spaceflight, space settlement?
Space settlement is wonderful if it's affordable and safe. It has to be both affordable and safe. And right now, the cost is so great that you can't afford the safety. The amount of radiation protection you need to go in space is truly massive. You can't do it with just regular material. It has to be some kind of an active system, which means you need some kind of revolutionary energy to power it or very good magnets. And we're currently looking at very good magnets, and there's a possibility we can do it with an active system with almost state-of-the-art magnets, but that's TBD. But, you know, once you put humans in space, even on a place where there's partial gravity, if it turns out partial gravity decimates the immune system, and so does the radiation. And the combinatorial effects, health-wise, of partial gravity and radiation have only been experienced by the few Apollo astronauts that we sent out. That was only for a few days. So this is all to be determined. And there's something else which I allude to in the paper, you know, which is a newbie as far as humans going and settling in space and so forth, is that we've discovered that when you put living organisms of most any stripe, bio experiments, in microgravity with radiation, that the bugs go south. They become much more virulent, much more of a problem. And the human gut contains, I think I've seen a number of like 10,000 various organisms. So if you put humans in space, you also put all of the various biota that the humans harbor in space also. And it is not out of bounds that such biota could, over time, in space, under radiation and microgravity, produce bio stuff which would be either corrosive or very corrosive or very much of a problem as far as pathogenesis. All of this is speculation at this point, but it's something that we need to sort out.
That's right out of a 1950s sci-fi movie where, the creature has mutated and gone, bonkers because of radiation.
Yeah, but we now have data. I mean, Ames, NASA's research center, has been doing experiments in space, and that's their conclusion. So I'm sorry it corresponds to your earlier sci-fi, Rob, but, that's what we have to live with, so... the places people want to put humans are currently, not very amenable to human habitation at all. This is not like taking a walk down in the Antarctic somewhere, where at least you have reasonable water and breathable air and so forth and so on, and almost reasonable temperatures. I mean, this stuff is really bad. Now, what we can do is we can affordably send a robot to terraform Mars. We've looked at it. It would take about 120 years with technology we can postulate. And by that time, we would probably have reduced the cost to the humans. When the ground and the air are right, we can send a human.
So... Is there data on the amount of time it takes for radiation to impact this gut bacteria, for example? So I'm thinking of the two missions that one wants to do, one-way missions to Mars, and the other one, the Dennis Tito mission, wants to do the 500-plus day loop around Mars. Is that enough time for radiation to impact the gut bacteria like you're talking about? Do we have timeline information?
We have a few experiments. It's not definitive. It's not understood. Biology is a very complex thing. This is not what we expected, but it's what we're observing. But no, we do not have enough definitization to state one way or the other.
So that's an unknown, unquantifiable risk for those types of trips.
Yes, and there's a section in this paper that goes into the problems. The main problems are cost and all the safety issues, radiation, microgravity, their combination, and then there's will this stuff last long enough? You put stuff in space and it starts to go bad. There's not many service stations up there to get it fixed.
There's probably no service stations up there to get it fixed. Carolyn is in Salt Lake City and says, David, I'm not accessing my phone tonight. However, I too downloaded the paper and I read it, and I was astonished to see that your guest tonight wrote on page 3 that a statement had been made at an Air Force workshop saying that space is mature and a declining field of endeavor in the U.S. On the one hand, I can understand why they might think space is a declining field of endeavor in the U.S., especially over the past several years, but how in the world could they say space is mature? Maybe the telecommunications industry is mature, but space is just beginning. Could you ask your guest to comment on that, please?
That was a comment that I heard at a meeting that I attended on how to reduce cost of access to space for the military out of the Air Force Space Command. It was about a year ago. That was their statement. And it was given orally. I don't think it was written down. But if you look at the existing technology that we keep trying to use, then they're not far off the mark. That's why I wrote this paper, to show that there are a plethora of farther-term technologies, which need to be triaged, very low TRL technologies, but several of them, just individually, could make a massive difference in the cost and therefore enable the treasure to put in the safety.
And yet we don't seem to be doing that, do we?
We're not doing very much of it. And that's because we seem to be fascinated by ever more applications of crudely the same old technology.
Do you see, you do write about this in the paper, so I kind of know the answer, but there's a lot of talk about privatization and the commercial segments and commercial markets, and many guests will come on the space show, for example, and they'll say NASA's not going to do anything. It's going to be the commercial sector that leads us into a terrific space policy and space future. Do you really see anything like that happening?
Yes. Does what Congress tells it to do and what the executive branch tells it to do. And right now they have laid out a list of missions, and that's what we're executing. The business of commercialization will have to be done by the commercial people, because I don't think Congress or the executive branch has told us to go and develop stuff for the commercial people, per se. The telecom business was an outgrowth of some experiments we ran, but it was done by private people, most of it. And that's been very successful, and they make money, with the current cost of access to space. But there's a lot of other things that the space commercial people want to do, which I don't think they have a business plan that closes using the available technologies.
So this includes like the mining of asteroids or some of the lunar ventures that you're talking about?
I have not seen a closed business case for much of that, no.
Is NASA in about the same position, the worst position, a better position than other national space programs, as best as you can tell, like ESA, China, Russia, India? Are we all sort of in the same boat together?
Yeah, pretty much. China is into space for national prestige, so they're kind of sort of like us in the 60s. But they're coming along fast. Russia's trying to reconstitute their space prestige and spacefaring business after a long downturn over the last couple of decades. But all of the countries are beset by this massive debt problem. They're all beset by several other problems that also affect society, such as the machines taking the jobs and unemployment. And the fact that there's currently, very knowledgeable people tell me that for the way we're now living and the number of us on the planet, we're short about 40% of the planet. And as the Asians come up to Western living standards, which they're trying to do, in their billions, we're going to be short about four planets. And even if we terraform Mars, it'll take us too long, and that's only one of the four planets we need. So, econometrics is going to have to change from a growth mantra to a sustainability mantra. And all three of these things, the debt problem, the robots taking the jobs, and the business with the ecosystem structures, these will all reduce the standard of living going forward. And that reduces the treasure that governments and people have to put into space.
Well, you've mentioned down the road terraforming for Mars. So, again, over the years, I've covered this a lot. But there is a huge ethical opposition to terraforming Mars. So I don't really know how that would wash out in terms of what kind of policy we would allow or we would eventually have. Do you have a pretty good feel that terraforming would be allowed?
It depends upon whether you want humans to live there. If you want humans to live there where they have to live within their little habs at huge expense and kind of perhaps not very healthily, or you can terraform it. Two things protect us here on this planet from galactic space radiation. Galactic space radiation, as I'm sure you've covered, is about 30 to 50 gigaelectron volts of iron nuclei and such.
Right.
And it's, very bad stuff. And we're protected living here on the surface by the magnetic fields, the Allen belts, and the atmosphere. Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, and it has very little by way of magnetic fields. What they have is very localized. So we can at least put an atmosphere on Mars, which we can breathe, and would protect us somewhat from the radiation. That's what we mean by terraforming. People tell me that there's enough water under this frozen CO2 on the poles, so that if we put some rather large membranes and did some solar concentration there, we could release enough water to put a shallow ocean in parts. And then there's all kinds of plants for planets you can put in there to make oxygen. And it, you know, it's fairly straightforward. Friends of mine have written books on this.
Well, and I, as I said, I've done a lot of shows about it, too. I won't see it in my lifetime, but maybe there'll be some forward-thinking people down the road who will go off in that direction.
Well, I wouldn't preclude, in your lifetime. We're currently extending human life at about 0.3 years per year. If you live another year, you get another 0.3 years to live. And the medical people looking down the barrel of the genomic and synthetic biorevolution say in 25 to 30 years, that 0.3 years per year could be 1 year per year.
Well, I'd be almost 100 then.
Well, that's fine. Just hang in there.
You have a caller, sir. Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And welcome to the show.
Hi. My name's Sal Cimarelli, and I noticed the topic was on revolutionary stuff.
Well, it was based on a paper that our guest has written. Hopefully you downloaded that paper and you read it. That's what we're talking about.
I didn't download it. I didn't read it. And I guess I'll have to go back and read it.
Do you have a question or a comment?
Well, Dr. Dennis was talking about different elements on Mars. And I'd like to suggest that on each planet, the whatever materials are there, whatever elements are there, were formed on that planet rather than deposited there from outer space. So that I like his idea of generating an atmosphere by introducing something that's needed to be combined with what's there. Because that sounds very practical.
So what is your question or comment?
My comment is that if we can take a position that all of the elements that are on any planet were generated on that planet, we can look at things a little differently. And like I said, I like his idea of introducing something, an element, that is needed to be combined with what's there now to formulate the atmosphere. And, well, my question is it an acceptable theory to assume that all of the elements on a particular planet were generated by that planet? That would be a question.
Well, planets are formed in various ways out of, various processes. Some are gas balls, some are dust accretions, and some are in between. And it depends upon which star exploded producing the stuff or whatever. The elements are not probably equally distributed among all of the places. In other words, you won't find all of them on all places, perhaps. And the planets, do not produce minerals and elements, after they become planets that I know of, although there is some of that going on deep within the Earth, people speculate.
That's the track I'm on. As far as I can see, for instance, hydrogen is still being produced somehow on Earth. And if it's producing hydrogen, then the other elements combine. Other elements may be produced also, which combine to form all the rest of them.
Yeah, there are nuclear processes going on, and in fact, at one time, there was a nuclear explosion in Africa from these geologic nuclear processes. In other words, the thing became critical enough to actually explode. And there are many elements capable of fission and so forth. So you're right. The elements do change.
Anything
else? Well, at least somebody's looking into that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sal.
Okay, bye.
Listeners, that opens up the line for those of you who'd like to use it, 866-687-7223. I think I can get this email in before we go to break at the halfway point. This is from Alex, and Alex is in Seattle. And he said, I'm wondering what your thoughts are because the suborbital industry seems like it's on the verge of explosive growth, both scientifically as well as economically, not just with the suborbital space tourism and the popularity of it, but also the citizen science movement, which seems to be far-reaching with a lot of big market share. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Suborbital is fine. We've been in that business a long time. We've been putting up sounding rockets of various flavors for many, many decades now. The suborbital technology is essentially supersonic aerodynamics. It has very little to do with space access at all or with space at all. It just happens to kiss the lower limits of the space arena, but it's not really space. The amount of energy that you put into suborbital is a tiny fraction of the energy that you need to go to low Earth orbit.
So many of the companies and the proponents talk about the companies involved in suborbital ramping up to orbital from suborbital. Is that a feasible direction to go?
Yes, it's feasible, but it's a very different technology with very different costs and very different safety problems.
So it's not necessarily a natural way to go.
It is not evolutionary, no.
Interesting. We are at the halfway point, so listeners, we're going to take our break at this point, and we'll come back with Dr. Bushnell and more in about 3 minutes. And again, if you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. We will be doing pretty much an on-time ending tonight, so don't wait until the last 30 seconds to make your phone call, like a lot of you like to do. Call early, and nobody will be rushed. 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. We are in the second part of our Tuesday evening space show program. Our guest tonight, Dr. Dennis Bushnell. We're talking about his paper, Advanced to Revolutionary Space Technology Options, The Responsibly Imaginable. And you have the URLs for this paper, so you can get it and download it on both of my newsletters, and it will be in the archive summary of this show as well. And we have caller John Hunt with us from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, John. Welcome to the Space Show. Go ahead with your question or comment for our guest.
Yeah, well, a lot of things here. It seems to me, weirdly enough, the main problem, part of it is just a fundamental lack of money. I mean, we need, if we're going to get these advanced technologies, we need to actually, like you say, triage some and then eventually select some and pursue them with a pretty long-term development program. I mean, well, you know, one thing that's discussed is the MHD, the Vastemir type propulsion, which I tend to be a bit of an advocate of. But the problem is we probably need to develop, unless we do get something really revolutionary like your the cold fusion type stuff or what they call it now, it would be a nuclear reactor that would be quite revolutionary compared to the types we actually run right now, you know, and that probably have to run a very high temperature cycle in order to be able to, you know, be thermodynamically effective in space and get enough energy. But, you know, who's going to really commit to the billions and billions to do something like that? That's the dilemma I see.
Well, some of the technologies like fusion would cost probably billions. The low-energy nuclear reactions, which used to be called cold fusion, when it started, we now have about 24 years of experiments worldwide showing both transmutation and energy generation repeatably. And it looks like it's real. The question is, what's real? We're still trying to figure out what the physics is. It's not particle physics. It's not the strong force. It looks like it's the weak force, and it looks like it's a condensed matter, nuclear physics, and collective effects. And this is a backwater of physics. Very few of the physicists in the country are trained in these areas, and that's why we've had such a deuced hard time trying to get this thing treated seriously. We have a set of experiments ongoing at NASA Langley trying to sort out whether the Wood-Marson theory, which is the weak force theory that we think is the best, is in fact correct. If it is, if it's proven out experimentally, then we intend to look into this seriously. There's no radiation produced by this, and we think we understand why. So conventional nuclear, which is very expensive and has all kinds of radiation problems and everything else and all kinds of weights and costs to protect from the radiation, the low-energy nuclear reaction stuff doesn't have any of that. And so it's a much cheaper and much more interesting technology. The theory says it's about up to 6 million times chemical. Conventional fission fusion is 10 to the 7th or so, 10 to the 8th, maybe 5 times 10 to the 7th. So, you know, it's almost fission nuke level, but without the radiation. People are measuring and claiming in the couple of thousand times chemical so far, and maybe that's all we'll get out of it, but that's a whole lot more than chemical.
Yeah, well, that would be a game changer to have something fundamentally new like that actually to be developed into a practical source. I actually have a friend who had some dabbling in this, but his connections are such that it's kind of a proprietary thing with a company, so I don't like. But he sort of had the similar attitude that you're expressing about the weak force, though. I do remember call that. So.
Well, what's the fascinating about it is it not only produces heat, but it also produces transmutation. So a previous caller talked about terraforming and whether or not the elements are there. If something that you want isn't there, there's a possibility going forward from what we think we know about this, what we've observed, that you can use an LENR process to produce the elements that you want. This is a tremendous game changer.
Are the machines that we hear about, Rossi's machine in Italy, ECAT or whatever it's called, is any of this real?
We don't know. We're trying to find out. What's interesting about this is it's not just Rossi. It's hundreds of people worldwide who have produced thousands of papers over 25 years. And, this is either mass hysteria or there's something there, and odds are now that there's something there. The question is, what is it? And if we can understand what it is, can we engineer it? Three or four or five labs have blown up doing these experiments. And every once in a while, people get it more right. So we have to make it safe. We have to engineer it. And to do that, we really need the theory. And that's why we at National Library are trying to sort out what the theory is.
John?
Well, that's certainly... Those are areas that are... What's interesting about it is it would look like that if you could get adequate amount of research on it, you might be able to produce something. I get the feeling that a lot of the mainstream science is just sort of opposed to it and is unwilling to commit any funds to it to speak of, except for certain niche areas that are, well, they say technology-oriented and maybe less science-oriented, perhaps.
Yeah, well, people are trying to do things commercially with their stuff, put them on the shelves at Walmart and so forth. And,
yeah.
And it's not clear whether they can do that safely yet.
Yeah.
I've done two shows in two consecutive years with Ed Storms, who you probably know.
Oh, yes.
And he he's kind of a frank guy, and he's frustrated with the levels of funding and the ability to move forward because of the lack of proper funding.
Yeah, but the lack of proper funding comes about because of a lack of proper physical understanding, theoretical understanding. And that's what we're trying to supply, okay? I mean, if, we come out from these experiments and say, okay, the weak force theory tends to explain this, and here's what we observe. I personally think that you will see this whole field burgeon like no other field has ever burgeoned because of its massive payoffs in terms of climate and energy and cost and so forth. The Rossi experiments, if they're real, suggest that a couple percent of the nickel we mine on the planet could produce all the energy on the planet at a cost of something like one-fourth that of coal. That's a big deal, and that's one of the reasons why we're trying to find out truth.
So given the potential importance and benefit of this, is this research adversely impacted by sequestration?
Not seriously.
Okay.
The amount of research money we're putting into this is so tiny that we're in the 18th decimal place of this desequestration problem.
So it's not a big deal because the amount of overall money is so small.
The amount of overall money is insignificant. We have one experiment going, and one small part of one little building with a couple of people working on it.
But
we think this is the definitive experiment.
Well, Ed, over the past couple of years, has been a great tutor to me and to Space Show listeners, and his pointing me to sources on the web like NER.org, I guess it is, and others have really had great papers and information. And I would just urge listeners to really look into this because it is really transformative if it can come together.
On SlideShare, if you Google Larsen, L-A-R-S-E-N, SlideShare, and L-A-N-R. You should be able to find, I think there's 19 slide decks on SlideShare from Larsen explaining all of this in very gory detail.
Okay. Thanks for that heads up. John, do you have more for our guest tonight, or do you want to go someplace else?
Well, yeah, it is interesting to try to stake your program on something that's very, I mean, obviously, in a way, I think that if you have tightly constrained budgets, the more, say, novel ideas tend to get frozen out first, you know, and you concentrate on, you know, the more traditional thing, where if you have more budget, you can kind of fund a bunch of side programs and, you know, electrostatic fusion or this or whatever, and maybe get a surprisingly good result, I guess.
Yeah, you need enough budget to look at several of these things. Which is what my paper is trying to advocate. There's a lack of courage, I think. It's more cultural, and it's more a near-term focus, a technical focus, an evolutionary focus, and a search for instant gratification. And the kind of breakthroughs that are needed to get space for humans beyond low Earth orbit, both safe and affordable, far more easily, is a longer-term, really hard road, but there's enough ideas around. This is why I wrote the paper, to indicate that there's enough ideas around so that it's worth doing.
Something to kind of keep it going. But I think there's also a case to be made to build, our Earth, I just think the current situation, the decision to retire the shuttle without an adequate replacement is just such a colossal blunder. Not the shuttle was perfect, but, you know, it's a lot better than nothing, and that seems to be kind of where we're sitting right now. And
well, you know, I've been in this business a while. I'm about to get my NASA 50-year pin. And so I, you know, worked on Gemini. I had an experiment on the third Gemini Titan shot, and I worked on Apollo, and I worked on Shuttle. In fact, I was responsible to the NASA chief engineer to certify the TPS on the Shuttle first flight. And so I worked Apollo, and on Apollo, we had money running down the street. We were told to interact with the contractors, and we put a large number of nines on everything for reliability. On Shuttle, I think it's documented that Congress gave us almost exactly half the money we said we'd need. Money was so tight that we were constrained in what we could interact with the contractors, and the number of nines on things for reliability was not as good as it was on Apollo. So we ended up with a shuttle system that was kind of delicate. And we first found that out when we were doing the drop test and the tile started falling off. And shuttle had problems with the wiring getting old, with hydrogen embrittlement, with all kinds of problems. And it was nowhere near the reliability in terms of loss of crew that we would have liked. The new system is going to be a factor of 3 to 4 at least, more life-saving for the crew.
What I was trying to say is one approach would have been, and my thought would have been, to a more evolutionary approach, which would be basically to come up with a new set of orbiters with all the incorporating the lessons learned from the original shuttle program, while a lot of the existing infrastructure is still viable. I mean, it seems to me like that the SRB problem had been pretty much solved after Challenger and so forth, and a lot of it, if I understand, was that they had a reliability problem, and the vehicle wasn't designed really for what we call maintainability. You had to disassemble so much to fix the problems you had that maybe if you built a second generation with all this in mind, you could have made one that would worked a lot better.
Yeah, that's true. The cost of launching shuttle, a large percentage of it, like 46%, was in the standing army. The refurbishment was not particularly cost-effective. So, yes, we could have done a better shuttle. The problem was, I think, the money to do that wasn't there. The amount of money that they gave Mike, who was the administrator at the time after the second shuttle disaster in the earlier hollows, the amount of money that he got was the same old money, and he had to reprogram the budgets, and, you know, so we got what we got, which is what was affordable.
But now we're basically going back to expendables, it looks to me like. I mean,
yeah. You know. Yeah, but that's because we have not yet figured out, although SpaceX is trying to do it with their Grasshopper thing, but we have not yet figured out how to do a viable reusable. If you look at what you have to do to make it reusable, which is put wings on it or some way to get it back and gear and everything else, that decimates the payload fraction. And the cost of the refurbishment is not low.
Look at the costs we're spending on SLS, and there we're getting just a really big chemical rocket again. So we're not really moving forward on the technology, are we?
No. SLS is not a technology leap by any means. There were several ways to do that. One is a lot of small rockets and putting stuff together in space, and the other is the big rockets. And the system decided to do the big rockets.
John, do you have another question or comment, or should I free the line?
I'll free the line. Let some other people have a chance.
Thank you very much for calling in.
Very interesting.
Listeners, the line is available again, 1-866-687-7223. You have a whole section in your paper dealing with the outlook for space commercialization and various space commercial things. So many people recommend that to facilitate space commerce, we need fuel depots on orbit. Do you have an opinion on that? Is that a way to move forward?
I'm sorry, what?
Fuel depots on orbit?
Oh, fuel depots.
Yeah.
Yes, if there's a cheap way to get the fuel up there. You know, this is in the same class and probably not as useful as repairing things on orbit. Because the cost of getting them up there, particularly up to GEO, is not small. And so when you run out of fuel or you run out of batteries or whatever, you know, it's not just the fuel depots. It's the whole refurbishment on orbit, you know, which is a good idea.
A lot of talk about orbital space tourism as well as, you know, the suborbital. And there have been, five or six people, maybe seven, that have paid millions of dollars to go to the space station. Do you see that as an emerging commercial industry and a possible driver for more space commerce, or is it sort of stuck at just what it is?
Well, it depends upon whether people are willing to sign up to the current reliability numbers, you know, which are something's going to blow up with your body on it. Every 100 launches or so. And there's also the fact that you're, you know, putting yourself in line for microgravity and radiation problems. The astronauts, you know, I've got a lot of good friends and a lot of people that used to work for me that are astronauts. And one of them went up to Mir, and it took him months and months, you know, when he came back, you know, before he could function well. People have had eye problems. People have had all kinds of problems from, you know, going into space. We just don't know enough yet, which is one of the things we're trying to do on ISS about, you know, what are the real health problems.
And that's in LEO. That's not beyond LEO.
Well, yeah, and the only difference between LEO and beyond LEO is generally inside the Van Allen belts, although ISS punches out of, you know, out of the Van Allen belts around the poles quite a bit. But so it's not yet full radiation. We had to send up special radiation protection for the female astronauts on ISS to protect their reproductive organs when they sleep. You know, ISS essentially had an aluminum tin can, so you have secondary radiation. If we go beyond LEO, we're going to have to do something serious about radiation protection. And currently, if you try to do it with the materials, that's serious, translates to huge launch weights.
Yeah, but then I just read an article in Space News by Boss, who's been on this show twice, saying that radiation's not going to be a problem for Mars One going to Mars. So are these people smoking something?
Well, it depends upon what your restrictions are and, you know, how much you want to subject your body to and what kind of protection you see. The Mars studies that I'm familiar with, which Langley does in the conjunction with Johnson and other people, say that radiation is not a pretty story. But there's other people who say that if you send older people, because carcinogenesis generally has a 10-year latency, so if you send people in their 50s and 60s and they sign up to, you know, whether or not that will shorten their life appreciably, some of the arguments, you know, go that way.
If you could be the, you know, the grand poopah here of space and everything that falls in it, what would be your highest priority to start on first to radically change the focus and the direction and the energy of our civil space program?
The key to space is energy. And so I would go after several advanced energetic things, including positrons stored as positronium for up to a couple of years. Positrons are 10 to the 9th times chemical. And you know, only produce something like half an MeV gamma, which you can do some fairly reasonable protection against. The LANR thing needs to be sorted out. There's a whole lot of very interesting diffraction, low diffraction energy beaming approaches coming along, and the beamed energy looks extremely interesting. So, you know, I would go after energy, because if we stop this better living for chemistry thing, and you know go after some seriously different energy, we can blow this whole space thing wide open. The other technology, which would have less but still very great effect upon space, is structural nanotubes. But currently we use carbon and boron nanotubes as replacement for carbon-carbon in composites, and get like factors of 40-50% better structural weight fraction. It is possible, we think, using various new approaches to make structural materials out of nanotubes. That's a factor of potentially 5 to 8, factor of 5 to 8, not percentage, factor of 5 to 8 dry weight reduction. That would be interesting. So this is what I'd work on. Okay, revolutionary energetics and revolutionary materials. Now, I'd work on enough of them so that I was assured of a good outcome.
You have another caller with us. Hello, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And welcome to the show.
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim.
But the comment about the Mars One and what he said about radiation, I believe he's going. I believe he's basing that on the recent Mars probe that had a radiation detection device there on it, and they detected on the journey from Earth to Mars about 660 millisieverts per year radiation dose. So that would be about 330 for a crew. And the average the radiation workers, according to U.S. regulations, max out at about 50 millisieverts per year.
So it's about...
I think you can get that sort of dosage all at one time, so long as that you get an early retirement or something. I think it's like
early okay. retirement
that
into
sort
the
of early retirement. I don't mean you're going to the grave. I mean as in you have a lifetime dosage that you can receive according to federal regulations.
I think you'll be in the space cemetery.
But well, there are various.
Well, I think the Russian cosmonauts had received about that much, and then some.
Well, there's some precancerous DNA damage that has been observed. I think the airline pilots and crew actually. Receive a higher dose. They are classified as radiation workers, and they receive a higher dose than people that work in nuclear power plants. I'm told that the dermatologist can tell whether somebody is a pilot or a co-pilot by which side of their face they get the cancer on. What happens is the radiation comes in. Peak neutron flux in the atmosphere is about 55,000 feet, right where SSDs want to fly. And that radiation comes into the aluminum tin cans we fly around in, produces secondary radiation inside. And the best thing to do to protect yourself is sit on the aisle in the back where the water-filled humans around you can protect you somewhat.
Now, there had been studies of airline pilots who had fewer health problems from getting radiation at high altitudes by taking extra antioxidants.
Yeah, well, going over the poles is the real problem. Okay, because the Van Allen belts dip in at the poles, and so you really get a dose when you fly over the poles.
Tim, anything else?
Oh, I'm trying to up something. There's supposed to be certain areas of the world that receive a large amount, receives unusually high amount of background radiation with no, and the people there, they couldn't detect any unusual high amount of cancer. I think it's somewhere in Central Asia, but I haven't been able to, I'm looking it up right now.
There's a lot of protactinium in Africa. There's a lot of other nuclear active, minerals in various places around the world.
Oh,
and there's also
here it is.
Now, of course, a lot of nuclear waste. I've seen a map of the high background radiation places around Moscow, and you'd be absolutely amazed. There's hundreds of them, primarily from waste from various activities.
Oh, I found it. The highest radiation doses from natural background radiation is in the state of Kerala and city of Chennai in southern India, which is about 30 millisieverts per year, which is compared to 50 millisieverts per year for U.S. radiation workers. And in Brazil and Sudan, exposure can reach 40 millisieverts per year.
We have looked at how much mass it would take of almost anything, and of course hydrogen is the best. This is not a lead problem, it's a hydrogen problem because it's high Z radiation. And It would take, to really protect people going to Mars, it would take three or four at least SLS launches in addition to the one or two you need for the rest of it to protect the humans.
Now, did you do any research on using magnetic fields for
that's ongoing, and we think actually there may be a pony in that pile. There's some preliminary studies recent on using superconducting magnets, and it almost looks good. So maybe we can do that, but of course we still need the energy to energize the magnets.
Are you familiar with a company in Italy called Cella, C-E-L-L-A, Energy?
No.
So my show yesterday with Zero Gravity Solutions that is doing more and more DNA and plant research on the ISS through CASES, talked about this company called Cella, which they said also had an American thing, and they have developed a hydrogen particle where 1 inch equals 9 inches of water for radiation protection. So when my show ended with Rich Godwin, I went to their website and I looked it up, and of course the radiation that they talk about is all for industrial use. They're not talking about anything for humans or flying to Mars. But
very, very different.
Very, very different, but very interesting. So I'm going to contact them and see if I misunderstood what the guest was talking about yesterday, or if they really do have something that 1 inch equals 9 inches of water.
Well, water's got a lot of oxygen in it, which is not as good as hydrogen.
So
what you want is liquid hydrogen. At one time, people used to tell me that you need about a half a meter of liquid hydrogen and you're okay, so you put the crew in the middle of the hydrogen tank. But the more recent studies indicate, it's going to take a lot more than that.
Well, it's some kind of a hydrogen pellets, and the guy had his handful of it on the website picture.
Well, hydrogen's hydrogen, and there's not much you can do with hydrogen to make it any better than hydrogen, and the most dense hydrogen people know about that you can contain fairly easily is liquid hydrogen.
Tim,
as opposed to hydrogen gas.
Tim, do you have anything else?
Yes, I have a question. Has he ever looked into, instead of more, maybe not advanced technology, maybe something more on the line of simple but stupid? Simple and stupid? I mean, keep it simple, stupid. That's the phrase. What I'm referring to is the big dumb booster idea. Pressure-fed rocket using maybe temperature, room temperature, storable propellant. And accepting the lower performance for much lower launch cost.
We've looked at that. The cheapest current space access that we can come up with is an Energia from Russia on steroids at Russian labor rates, which is about $800 a pound to orbit. Low Earth orbit. That's the best anybody can do. SpaceX, with their advanced version and their Grasshopper, say that they're going to do better than that. But that's still not a factor 10. That's a factor 2 to 3.
I wouldn't complain too much about it. I mean, even a factor of 2 and 3 would be a big improvement.
2 or 3 would help, but it's not going to enable all the commercial stuff that people want to do.
Anything else, Tim? Otherwise, I want to make it available if someone wants to call. We're getting close to the
end. Now, is the bulk of the cost coming from the development cost, or is it coming from the cost of labor? I'm just curious. Material?
Currently, launch costs are about, decent system, about 20-25%. Overhead and ops, and the rest of it's the vehicle and all of its parts. And you can go robotic and get those costs down. The actual cost of the fuel was nothing. I mean, fuel is cheap, oxidizer is cheap. It's all about mass fraction, which is why you do materials, and it's all about energy, which is why offboard energy via energy beaming, you know, fascinates me so much. And in fact, it's possible if you want to go to Mars to go up to orbit with an empty gas tank and deorbit slightly, take in outer region atmospheric air, add a little bit of alkaloids to it, and a beam energy to it, and do a 1-2 G acceleration out of the gravity well, so that you don't have to, you know, put any fuel per se in orbit, because you've separated propulsive mass and energy, whereas combining them in a fuel is what we do now.
Tim, I got to move on in case somebody else wants to get in.
All right, I will.
Thanks. Listeners, the line is clear if you want to get in before we end our program, 866-687-7223. Charlie is in Tucson, Arizona, sent in a note and says, Dr. Bushnell, did you write your paper for a specific NASA audience? If so, what was that target audience, and what has been the feedback and reaction?
I wrote it for not only NASA, but for the world, because spacefaring is a world endeavor. It was not NASA-centric per se. It's everybody who wants to go to space. And I wrote it to document that there is a great many potentially revolutionary technologies that need to be looked at and triaged and studied and researched. That it's not the same old, which is what we've been trying to do forever. I mean, the access to space thing has been worked worldwide with all kinds of variations on the usual technologies. Nobody's found a superb new breakthrough solution space. We're all muddling around with the same stuff. You've got to do something different, and the only way to do something different is do something risky and low TRL. And the way to do that is to look at multiple solution spaces.
What has been the reaction to?
The reaction has been favorable from the usual suspects that like this kind of stuff, and missing from the rest.
Missing, not even indifference, or
that's right. Well, I mean, indifference is missing.
What about from other countries? Did you get feedback from ESA and
nothing
others?
Nothing directly from other countries. No.
Interesting. This is probably going to be our last question of the evening, and this is Roger in Portland, Oregon. And he said, since you're mentioning beam technologies as possibly interesting and exciting, do you have any thoughts on the potential of the space elevator or possibly a lunar or Mars elevator?
The elevators are a single point of failure problem, which I don't like single point of failure systems. There's all kinds of atomic oxygen around, which will eat this stuff up, people tell me. The cost is huge. It's a huge capital investment. The stuff that I talk about is, I think, much better from a cost, investment, reliability standpoint than the space elevator.
In terms of winding down our conversation tonight, if you had any suggestions for us or advice. Is this about advocacy, writing letters to members of Congress, writing letters to NASA for doing things different, taking on more risk, doing more future forward-looking things? What are, other than sitting on the sideline or just being an advocate or championing something as an advocate or an enthusiast, what are we to do out here who are really interested in space and what you're talking about?
Okay, this is not just a space problem. In the industrial age, we created wealth by raping natural resources. now in the IT age, we create wealth by inventing things. To invent things, you have to take risk, and you have to do a tremendous number of ideation. And so in space and in everything else this country does, if we're going to get back on top, we have got to get very creative. So I would ask everyone to be as creative as they possibly can, and by doing so, they will ensure that their job will be one of the last that the robots take over.
One of the last that the robots, so the robots will eventually take it over.
We are currently working in the IBM Blue Brain Project and six others. Ones are nearly the same. Nanosectioning in the neocortex, the higher part of the mammalian brain, and replicating it in silicon. And the IBM Blue Brain Project people have made such great progress that they say in 10 to 12 years, they will market a human-level biomimetic machine intelligence. Once that happens, all bets are off.
10 to 12 years from now.
That's what they said.
I'll be 80 years old. It's an interesting world with a lot of interesting potential, and space should play a huge role in it if all we're going in the right path. Why do you think that we don't see space become a big issue in national political elections?
Space is currently a very successful, very important plethora of Earth utilities. And that's weather and telecom and observations and all kinds of other stuff. And that's very healthy, thank you. It makes money, it functions well, and it's not changing very much. Anything else besides scientific research and exploration, but anything else simply does not have a closed business case. And that's the problem. Okay, I spent 6 months of my life looking for some way to make commercial space successful from a closed business case. And, in this paper we've been discussing, I included a section, as you said, on commercial space.
Right.
That's the result of my 6 months of study on this thing. We tried just hundreds of ways to commercialize station back in the late 90s and got nowhere. The stuff that we thought would be good when they did the simulators on the ground, they got just as good results and far cheaper than going to space.
So that remains elusive at the best.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is, aside from Earth utilities, which are very successful, it's not clear. And a lot of people want to do a lot of things, but when they, toed up the costs and the risks and everything else, without these technologies that I discuss, there's just no closed business case that I'm aware of.
Well, if on chance some of these new commercial ventures do actually perform close to what their assumptions say they're going to perform, including on the timeline they claim, that could change things.
I still want to see their closed business case.
That could change things if that actually happened, right?
No. I have given them, in my space commercialization studies, given them, everything they claim.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And I still can't find a closed business case. We've been studying this for decades. And at one point in the late 90s, when we tried to commercialize stations seriously, we had a budget of hundreds of millions of dollars to look into this. And thus far, it's a subject rather than an object.
So what do you say to the people out there trying to do this and that form their companies? And you've got CASIS, which is trying to help commercialize projects on the station.
NASA will help work with, consult for anybody that, we're a public utility for the nation.
Uh-huh.
and, you know, we will try to help them. But, you know, I personally would like to see their closed business case.
Okay. Dennis, I think your paper is excellent, and I think it's a must-read for anyone interested in the subject. And we will have it on the website, and we'll continue to talk about it. And I hope to talk to you again down the road. Do you have any more big papers like this in store?
Well, I did one slightly earlier, a couple months earlier, for aeronautics. You know, this one was for space exploration. I did a similar one for aeronautics, which espouses the air traffic control, which would enable 30 or 40 million UAVs in controlled airspace for, you know, personal use. These are UAVs carrying passengers, otherwise known as the personal aircraft.
Is that on a website like this one?
Yeah, it is. Send me an email tomorrow, and I'll send you the text.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put it in the archives of the show as well. I'd also like to read it.
Yeah. But you know, but it's for aeronautics. It's not for space.
Well, still fascinating related topics.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I appreciate it, and I hope to talk to you again down the road someday.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And that's it, listeners. Remember, no show Friday, as I'm off to the New Space Conference, back again on Sunday. Good night, everyone, from the Space Show.